This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Jim Sheeran. Jim, it's good to have you here this morning.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So the way we start the show is with the question, who are you? And that's a big question, but you can take it however you wish.
Well, I guess I'll go biographically. I grew up as the oldest child of six, mm-hmm. So in a big family up in Utica, New York.
Sure.
Ended up attending college at SUNY Cortland and moving after that to the Binghamton area.
So just kept moving south in increments.
Moving south, gradually, is where the work took me, actually.
Uh-huh, right.
Went to school to become an English teacher and did that for a few years, 3 years, actually. And then eventually, and in that time, got married and had a child, and who's 27 now. And then eventually, as far as career paths went, I went from being an English teacher to being a police officer, where mm-hmm. I spent the rest of my career, 20 years as a police officer. Been retired about 8 years and teaching now at SUNY Broome, and mm-hmm. Also running a program for convicted drunk drivers, the New York State Impaired Driver Program.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. It's a very interesting collection of experiences, and I'm sure we're going to unpack them as we go through the next hour. So you also brought some music with you, and you wanted to start this morning with Perfect Day by the Constellations on the album Southern Gothic, right?
Right.
And so that's what we're going to start with, and we'll pick up with those connections in a minute. To WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Jim Sheeran. So, Jim, tell us about the song you just picked for us to start the show with. How did you find that? Why did you pick that song?
Well, I like picking up songs on iTunes, and this song just, different parts of it just kind of resonated with me, and I like the... some of the imagery, I guess, with the perfect days, and then a little sarcasm in it too. So.
Right, right. A little attitude and a little earnestness.
Yep.
Okay. So in your introduction, you mentioned that you've gone from being an English teacher to a police officer.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, you know, how did you make, what happened in your life, and maybe something of consequence or no consequence at all, what happened to shift your focus in the way that it did?
Well, it was something that I think had always been in the back of my mind as far as I was influenced, first of all, to become an English teacher by a couple of really excellent teachers that I had in high school. And then as I went on to be an English major in college, just had some really excellent professors at SUNY Cortland who really kept me going in that direction, just as models of good teachers. When I went out into the actual teaching world, English teachers at the time were a dime a dozen. And I had worked in a couple of different school districts, actually three different school districts, because I was taking 1 year temporary positions.
Yeah, yeah.
And that got old after a while. And during that time, a friend of mine who was already a police officer had asked me if I was interested in taking the police exam. So I took the civil service exam, and about a year and a half later, got hired. And I found that for whatever reason, it was a really good career fit for me. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed, there wasn't a day where I dreaded going to work. I liked it. And I was able to do quite a few different things during those 20 years.
Right. So did you work what's interesting is you chose law enforcement as a way to stabilize your work life, you know, after having going from being an English teacher, a peripatetic, teaching from one short-term contract to the other. Did you spend your career in one agency?
Or? Yeah, I worked for the Village of Endicott Police Department.
Okay, so a small agency.
Small agency, right around, over the course of my career, probably averaged, like, including the chief and everybody, probably 35 officers, which across the nation, it's actually a medium-sized police department, but we always thought of it as a small department. In a small town. And it's actually a larger department for a small town.
For a small town, sure. Sure. What attracted you to the work? I know how you got into the work, but what made it so that you liked going to work every day?
The variety. Once I got into the job, I mean, especially doing patrol work, every day is different. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of downtime. There's a lot of things that you are very mundane parts of the job, but when something happened, I mean, it was different. So you meet a lot of different people. There were different situations. You become a problem solver.
Right, right. So when you go from a mundane day to an event, what happens to you? What happens to your body? What happens to your emotions and your mind when you make that transition?
Well, depending on the event, I mean, some of the things, even though you do them every day, mm-hmm. there's a bit of an adrenaline rush as far as like a serious car accident, something like that, where you have a job to do, you know what you're doing. But then there are other situations as far as you go on, let's say, domestic situations, which you handle every day.
Right.
Some of them are very much the same, even though the players are different. But there are situations where you have to treat each situation individually, because there are shades of difference in everyone's situation depending on who you're dealing with.
Right. And the shades of difference have to do with accountability or crisis or what's it?
The type of crisis, the type mm-hmm. of personalities that you're dealing with, the mm-hmm. amount of, let's say, frustration and anger on the part of the people that are involved in it. And you have to handle them well, you have to be a good listener. Uh-huh. And think about what's in front of you.
As you, what prepared you in life to be ready to take on that kind of a role? What about your growing up or studying English that helped you to kind of be prepared for meeting people in those situations?
Well, there were some things which I felt I was prepared for as far as being a person who was somewhat outgoing and enjoyed meeting other people. But at the same time, I think it helped to grow up in a family where, you know, my parents worked hard and did okay. But with six kids, there were times when money was tight, and that helped me, I think, realize what goes on in other people's lives.
And especially since the people who disproportionately come in touch with law enforcement are relatively poor.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think there were things that I wasn't ready for too, as far as, the high school I went to was very much suburban, middle class. All my friends were, you know, a pretty similar group as far as what our backgrounds were and, you know, economically and socially. And
They probably didn't have six siblings or five siblings.
Right.
Because you're kind of at the tail end of that era.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, as far as realizing how different some people think, how different their lives are. There are some people, let's say that, for some people, everything's a crisis.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. And there are affluent people for whom everything is a crisis.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's no respecter. Anxiety is almost no respecter of social status.
Right, absolutely. And that was, I think, something I had to get used to. I had to, going from teaching into police work, the biggest thing I had to get over was that as an educator, you're taught to seek the best in people all the time. And as a police officer, you have to realize that some people aren't at their best all the time. People will try to, you know, for instance, people will lie to you, you know, I had to learn that there were people trying to get one over on me, you know, here and there. So, and that was a skill I had to develop.
And you have to question everyone.
Correct.
In the sense of being, there's a sense in which skeptical can mean, you know, I don't trust you and I doubt everything you say. But skeptical can just mean, I'm going to think about that and I want to see if it all hangs together with the rest of the story.
Right.
And that quality of being curious and open, but a little bit wary.
And once you learn that and learn that, it's just people, it's their natural inclination to not want to tell you the truth if they did something wrong.
Yeah.
And once you learn to do that, and you're not going to hold it against the person, it's just this little hill you have to get over with people. But once you learn how to, that, what you described is...
Right. And it takes you out of being the arbiter of truth in that particular instance, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, and as an officer, that's not your role, which is a neat place to be, because you can hear the story and respond to it and analyze it, but you're not necessarily judging it.
Correct.
Yeah. I guess one of the things that I'm really curious about is how. And actually, maybe we should cut to a song. Is there a song you would like to cut to now, or because I have a question too. My question is, in literature, you're taught to take apart characters and see the complexity of their lives in a way that, to me, it would just seem like a perfect preparation, totally counterintuitive, but a perfect preparation for police work.
Oh, the way that you analyze something like a poem or a story or a book is very similar to the way you do an investigation.
So and can you unpack that?
Sure. I think once you learn to look at something, and I think like English major talk, once you learn to look at something critically, and you're searching for meaning, you're searching for nuances, that skill translates very well to law enforcement and law in general. I think I've always heard that being an English major was a good preparation for being an attorney.
Uh-huh.
And,
true, sure.
And not just the writing, but the way you look at things. And I found that was very helpful, and as far as putting things together logically and thinking about things, and that whole way of thinking was a great help to me.
So now, what should we go to next for our second song?
I'd say Contact.
Okay. And this is Citizen Cope, Contact.
Undercover checking you to see, they checking your ID, cause it's a fine time, it's a fine time, it's a fine time, say just a runner name, cause you look the same as a dude with the rebel in his vein, so why you checking me, you got them crooked politicians, eating up the treasury and taking our cash, to spend on the prisoners while the youth they pass, now I'm waiting on the day when we undercover checking you to see, they checking your ID, cause it's a fine time, it's a fine time, it's a fine time, say just a runner name, cause you look the same as the dude with the rebel in his vein, say why you checking me, you got the crooked politician, eating up the treasury and taking our cash, to spend on the prisons while the youth they pass, now I'm waiting on a day when
Contact, and you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Jim Sheeran. And, well, Jim, you have described to us in a little bit of detail, but not a lot. You've had three careers as an English teacher, and then in law enforcement. I imagine you did several things in law enforcement, and then coming out of law enforcement, teaching, and also running the program for people with substance abuse issues, mm-hmm. Drunk driver program. Most of us are going to have three or four or even up to five or six different careers over the course of our life, but we don't tend to get our education with that in mind. We tend to think we're going to go out and we're going to work. But what you described, you weren't prepared coming from a middle-class white suburb to deal with the diversity of humanity that you've run, that you ran into as a law enforcement officer. I imagine they might have right. felt some of that in the school, in the classroom too. But what have you had to learn, and how have you, what have you done, and how have you done it to become more sensitive?
Well, I think a lot of it is just trying to understand where people are coming from, and then, but also making an effort to educate myself as far as whether that was formal coursework or in-service work, or, and then actually, you know, maybe it's trite to put yourself in the other guy's shoes, but looking at it, there's a reason for everything. You know, you see a problem in front of you, or a person in front of you, and as far as, I guess, trying to understand where they're coming from,
right?
And so it was a learning experience growing up, where pretty much all my friends' parents made the same amount of money.
Right.
Nobody was rich, nobody was poor, and pretty much I went to a large high school, and pretty much the whole school was like that. I
mean, yeah.
And so when going out into people's homes, I guess as a police officer was the biggest eye opener. And I think, you know, I worked in the same community that I had taught in.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the best example I can give is that I had, as an 8th grade English teacher, I had one young girl in my class who, for pretty much the entire school year, did not speak more than a couple of words, no matter how I tried to elicit things, and didn't do her homework, didn't do well in school, no matter what we tried to do. Within probably my first week as a police officer, I was in her parents' house, and they were both parents were, they lived together, the whole family lived together, but both of her parents were abusive alcoholics toward one another, toward the family.
Sure.
And once I saw that, you know, boy, that answered a lot of questions as far as why she didn't have her homework done. That wasn't important in her life, you know, just surviving. And that opened my eyes to teaching situations. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, getting out there as a police officer and seeing situations like this on a daily basis. That's not unusual for
right.
a cop to see.
No. And I work for an organization where it's really important that we are in the homes of participants, because we have our groups and have our meetings and our educational activities in people's homes. So we really get to see each other's lives. And in many ways, our attitudes about privacy keep us from knowing each other. We confuse the self-determination piece, which if you'd have known that girl's situation, you might have engaged her in a different way as a teacher.
Right.
But that's held in a private way as opposed to a personal way. And we don't know it. And law enforcement oftentimes are the only people who are really walking in doors where most of us don't.
I had, right after my retirement from the police department, the school district, Union Endicott Schools, hired me as their supervisor of attendance. And what you were working with truancy and residency and that type of thing. And the position didn't really involve like hauling kids back into school. In fact, I never did that in a year and a half. But what it involved was going out into people's homes and with that set of eyes. And really, I did it for 20 years, but looking at it from a different perspective, from a like a truancy perspective,
sure,
was opened my eyes again as far as what's going on in people's homes and lives.
You know, what you describe as a skill, and you called it as the word, the expression kind of tried as, you know, being in another person's shoes or taking their perspective. You know, that is that's the basis of empathy or the basis of understanding. And when we think of law enforcement or think of cops, we don't necessarily think of understanding or empathy as the thing to lead with. But that's what you're describing.
Yeah. And I think a good, you know, a good police officer, I mean, one doing the job well and doing it correctly, has to have that to a certain extent. There are times where it doesn't come into play, where you, at that particular moment, it's not important to understand.
You have a job to do and you have to do it
right
at that moment.
But it is the what you use to look at the underlying causes when you're trying to solve the larger problem in a community, for instance.
Right, right. Or I would imagine it's the attitude with which you approach the situation, but in the middle of it, you may need to be less sensitive in order to be firm and effective.
Correct. And you firm and businesslike and, yeah, and treating everyone the same. And
right, right. And I think if we as a culture modeled that process of getting to know, engage, challenge, and move on as citizens, that would become a more commonly understood process, and it wouldn't just be under the responsibility of law enforcement, because that's where we kind of have a role in terms of understanding what gives and what doesn't give, and modeling how to understand and how to confront.
Right, because there are ways, as you know, where you can confront people correctly, I guess, and solve a problem.
You get their attention without getting them to shut down or to fight back.
Right,
and that understanding virtue in the middle of a conflict is incredibly important.
Mm. And it comes back to listening. And
right. Is this something that comes more from your personality? Because you do, I mean, you impress me as a person who is inclined to think this way. But also, how did training or work or supervision help you to get more clear about what this is about?
Well, I'll give you one example. Early in my police career, we went into a husband and wife domestic argument situation, and I hadn't been married more than probably 3 or 4 years myself. And I went in, and I was a brand new officer, and my lieutenant was with me, and he had been on the job probably 15 years or so. And so I worked through this situation with this couple, and we wrapped up and walked out of the place, and the lieutenant looks at me and says, "You have no idea what you're talking about, do you?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "Well, you just haven't been through this type of situation before, so mm-hmm. you don't." And he was trying to do it constructively, but he,
right.
I think I took offense at first. But in looking back on it, what he said was correct. I really didn't have the life experience at that time to help these people the way they needed to be helped.
And what did you do, and what did you need to do differently? Can you share that? I mean, without revealing.
Well, I think. Having a better understanding of why a husband and wife would, you know, get to a point where they had to call the police to settle mm-hmm. an argument.
Right.
Because this thing, there wasn't...
Was there battering involved?
No, in this particular situation,
it was
a loud
battering
argument.
Yeah.
And there was no hint of anything physical or even threats of anything physical that had happened.
Mm-hmm.
But so a very, really open and shut, simple situation where I still didn't know. Probably, I didn't have a life experience yet to know what I needed to know. So a lot of it's that. A lot of it's...
How would you have handled it differently, knowing what you came to know?
Well, probably just giving better advice as far as... in this case, it was a situation of just treating, you know, how you're going to...
Treat each
for
other.
Now, go to your separate corners, but then right. how are you going to get past this particular day where things were bad enough where... somebody called the police.
Right, right. And I guess and policing has taken in the 60s and 70s and 80s, it was there was not a lot of competency in policing around domestic issues, and they were taken to task on that. And there seems to have been an increase in skill level, particularly in some departments more than others. And it seems to come from an understanding that there is a trajectory to in the way conflict plays out in couples.
I think the training now is much better. The training, the way we're training police in the academy, is better. The way the expectations of the community are higher, which is good. Mm-hmm. Your policies where, let's say, an arrest is appropriate and needed, you know, you have a lot of district attorney's offices backing pro-arrest policies where it's needed. And,
right, and where you need it for safety or cool down, even if there's not necessarily anything that's happened at this particular.
Right, and, taking the ability to determine an aggressor and remove mm-hmm. a party and so forth, because there, you know, you look back 25 years or so, no matter what was going on, if nobody wanted anybody arrested, it was case closed.
Right.
And we look at it much differently now, and we're much better at working with our victims too.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that's kind of what I was wondering if was at play. Let me do the station ID and let's think about next music. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Jim Sheeran. So where should we go to next?
I'd say just the other side of nowhere, Johnny Cash. Tune.
Okay. And do you want to introduce that, something about that, why you picked that, or what does it speak to you?
Well, I like the worst song. I'm not sure who wrote it. I don't even know if Johnny Cash wrote it. Mm-hmm. I like his. I've heard it in other versions. I like his particular version just because of the. It's just him and a guitar.
Mm. Yep. Yep.
I come from just the other side of nowhere. To this big time lonesome town. They got a lot of ice and snow here. Ain't half as cold as all the people I found. Everywhere I try to go here, somebody's always trying to bring me down. I've seen about enough to know where I'll be bound. I've got a mind to see the headlights shining on that old white line between my heart and home. Sick of spending Sundays wishing they were Mondays, sitting in the park alone. Give my best to anyone who's left, who's ever done me any loving way but wrong. And tell them that the pride of just the other side of nowhere's going home. Taking nothing back to show there for these dues that I've paid. But the soul I almost sold here and the body I've been giving away. Fading from the neon nighttime glow here, heading for the light of day. Just the other side of nowhere, going home. I've got a mind to see the headlights shining on that old white line between my heart and home. Sick of spending Sundays wishing they were Mondays, sitting in the park alone. Give my best to anyone who's left, who's ever done me any loving way but wrong. And tell them that the pride of just the other side of nowhere's going home. Mm-hmm. I got a mind to see the headlights shining on that old white line between my heart and home. Sick of spending Sundays wishing they were Mondays, sitting in the park alone. Give my best to anyone who's left, who's ever done me any loving way but wrong. And tell them that the pride of just the other side of nowhere's going home.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that was Johnny Cash and Just the Other Side of Nowhere. And our guest on this hour is Jim Sheeran. Jim, we were talking about how Johnny Cash kind of changed the tone of his music and the tone of his life over the years. And I'm just wondering now, one of the questions I like to ask guests is, how have you changed? How has life pushed you to grow in ways you never would have chosen? And how has it been easier than you might have anticipated? But first, how has it been harder? And what have you had to learn you didn't think you'd have to?
Well, I think over my life, I've learned to become a little, I don't want to say less serious, but I don't take things as seriously, as far as things being a problem or a crisis or whatever. I've learned how to just let things roll off my back a little bit better.
So by rolling off your back, what's something that's happened where you've, and how was it different?
Well, I think when I was younger, I let things bother me a little bit more. I took things to heart a little bit more. And as far as an attitude, an insult, or whatever.
So you focused on them inside of yourself, yeah. even if you didn't share them with other people.
I guess one of my jobs right now, working with convicted drunk drivers, they're people that are coming in. They've been through the system. They've really gotten all their punishment and everything. And we're pretty much the last stop for them before they're relicensed or paid their fines or whatever. And one of the things, when I first started, I mean, I was used to treating people in a certain way with respect and so forth, and getting them to comply with whatever the program required and so forth. And one of the things that was said to me by one of my supervisors was, well, you know, the person that did this job previously, really, I let a lot of things bother them. They got into a lot of arguments with the drivers, and you don't. I said, well, there's really, it's very simple. I mean, there's nothing to argue about. And if somebody does call with an attitude, I don't take offense at it. And usually we come to a point where they understand what they need to do, and we move on, because that's, you know, the program's geared toward having people be successful.
Right, right. I guess, and the story that you're telling suggests, you know, there are times when people have an attitude that we can react to. And we can take it personally. And there are times when people have issues with us, and they're bringing us that attitude where we need to take it seriously because they have an issue with us personally. And distinguish between when people have an issue with life and they're taking it out on the whole world, or they have an issue with the system and they're taking it out on you, and you happen to be the person who represents the last step of the system of getting their license back. You don't take that personally. But so you've learned a little finer, I'm thinking you learned a finer grain of what to take seriously and what not to take seriously.
Right, because there are certain things, and there are life situations where obviously you have to look at it in terms of, hey, this is actually a crisis. So let's, you know, we have to go into that mode. But as far as, I guess the one thing I've learned is I don't take insults personally, usually. I mean, it still happens, but I think that's the biggest way that I've changed.
Right. And did you find that I would imagine that you would find, as you went from being an English teacher to a police officer, you had more occasions to experience insults.
Oh, if daily.
So not taking them so personally makes a whole lot of sense and is a learning curve. Has it changed your relationship in your family, with your family?
As far as...
as being able to let things go and wait and see.
Well, I'd like to think so. I mean, there are times where I think in any family, any relationships, tiny little things become big things. And I still catch myself in those situations where... you know, I could have been more reasonable.
Right. But I guess the difference is between catching yourself and then doing something to change the situation versus not catching yourself and continuing to justify your complaint. That's a big difference.
Yeah. And I can come around pretty quickly usually. So, And so that's better. I mean, like, and I think as you grow older and a relationship matures, like a family mm-hmm. relationship with your spouse or your children or whatever, you like to see it go in that direction where, hey, the big picture is important. We're all getting older and we like, you know, let's concentrate on how we feel about each other.
Right. So the need to become, to let things roll off you, was that because you kind of started out with a personality or were raised in a family where you're really supposed to take everybody and everything really seriously? That's the sign of maturity.
Well, with my parents having six kids, I heard one person one time describe a big family like that as the parents having a reign of beneficent neglect, you know, and I think you really have to do that with uh-huh. to raise six kids successfully, because when you've got six people with six different things going on and they're six different ages and they're all over the board, you can't take everything to heart. You have to, some things are important, some things are not in the big picture.
And you can't take on their stuff. I'm one of seven kids. I'm the sixth of seven of eight born. There was one who died just before me died as an infant. But the people in the town where we grew up have said of us, we've never seen seven such different people mm-hmm. come out of a single household, because we have very different attitudes and approaches. We look a lot alike, that's which is deceptive, but we have very different quirks. And part of that is from this benign neglect. Our parents, mm-hmm. you know, they wanted to see is this a safety issue? Is this a matter of getting everybody out the door properly dressed, or is this just something else? In which case, we're not going to pay attention to that,
right? Yeah. And that's the way my parents ran the show was that they and all of us. If you looked at the six of us, I would say we're similar in a lot of mm-hmm. ways. From our personalities are very similar to our career choices were mostly pretty similar. The way we've gone on to live our lives, we've all ended up doing okay. We're happy. Mm-hmm. We're in the, and everybody's in a pretty good place in life.
Right. And are you among the younger of the siblings or the older?
I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest. Okay. Okay. And that is very good, because you guys came of age as the economy was tanking. In terms of the oil embargo and the rounds of depressions and stuff.
Yeah, one of the biggest examples, I guess, that I saw, a good example, was my dad got laid off from General Electric in Utica in 1970. I was 10 years old. I'll never forget it. They had just had their sixth child, just bought a new house. And he got laid off from a place he had worked at since he was 18. And
wow.
Saw the way they put things together and handled that for the year that he was laid off. My mom luckily was an RN and she went back to work, but it was a tough year.
Mm-hmm. And how did they handle it? What impressed you about the way that they dealt with what was? I mean, that's the early 70s. That's being laid off, and in those days was a point of extreme shame for men. It has become less so. Mm-hmm. It still is a tough issue. But
just that my dad went out, strung together two, three part-time jobs at a time, just seeing that as an example, seeing my mom going back working the night shift, sleeping during the day when she could, and it was tough. The way they got through it, the way they kept food on the table and kept the house barely, and then got back on their feet when he was able to go back to work.
Sure. Sure, and what you described as a middle class experience was a tenuous middle class experience, which we also referred to early, but that gives it a much stronger picture.
Yeah, they there were things they didn't tell us till years later about that period of time, but as far as how tight things really were, but just seeing the example that they showed was really something I'll never forget.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What do you take away from your parents in terms of things to emulate and things to not emulate?
Well, I think the gracefulness with which they handled a lot of situations with us kids, it was pretty remarkable looking back on it. Because there were, you have six people, you're going to have six sets of problems at times. And so that was something I consistently saw. Their work ethic, in spite of working hard, but also their volunteerism. And I think that's what most of us, most of their children have picked up as far as...
When you have six kids, you can't do everything for them, and you rely on other people to step in and do it. And one of the ways to make that happen is to volunteer yourself. And it just, and then my parents ran youth groups, and even when Dad didn't go to church, he still ran the youth group because he had an issue with one of the stances they took in the church. But they still, he was still scoutmaster and youth leader. So,
yeah, and I think that the way they did that for so long, and the way that they were able to keep a handle on everybody's lives. My mom called me every Sunday night till a couple of weeks before she died. So just to check in and see what was going on.
Sure.
My dad's still living up in the Utica area, and just, he turned 80 back in July, and he volunteers at two different places as far as in a children's museum, and he volunteers in a nursing home up there too.
Sure. And what did you stake out to be different? What was important to you that you make it different? And that's no judgment on them. It's just a judgment of what you saw and valued that was different than what they did.
I can't really think of anything.
Okay.
I always... got along well with my parents outside of your normal teenage skirmishes.
Sure.
They were very supportive of me, through my whole life without interfering and with letting me live my own life. And, but always were there. And, I tried to take that to my own life with my son and do the same.
Sure. You have one son?
One son.
Yeah. Cool. We have time for one more song before we go into our last batch of questions. Would you like Twilight Time?
Twilight Time would
be
great.
Okay. And this is Jenny Scheinman. I believe that's how you pronounce it. I hope. Yeah.
Think so.
Heavenly shades of night are falling. It's twilight time. Your voice is calling. It's twilight time. When purple colored curtains mark the end of day, I hear you, my dear, at twilight time. Deepening shadows gather splendor. Sun. I count the moments, darling, till you're here with me. Together at last at twilight time. Here in the afterglow of day, we keep our sweet and same old way. I fall in love again as I did then. Deep in the dark, your kiss will thrill me like days of old, lighting the spark of love that fills me with dreams untold. Each day I pray for
And that's Jenny Scheinman and Twilight Time. And our guest on this hour is Jim Sheeran. So, Jim, the way I like to close the show is to ask the guest, what do you do on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, occasional basis to restore yourself to emotionally, physically, intellectually, so that you are kind of, you know, back in a good space?
Well, every day I tend to get up earlier than I need to. And usually that's...
Earlier than you need to. And what is that about?
Well, nobody else is up. And so usually it gives me about an hour to grab a cup of coffee, grab whatever I'm reading at the time. And usually I'll just sit and read. And sure, that helps me get my day started. Without that, I tend to miss it when I don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Is there any particular thing that you read at that time?
Usually whatever book I'm into at the time, and I am all over the board in my reading preferences. Mm-hmm. So
the English teacher lives.
Yes. Yeah. Lately, the past few years, it's been more nonfiction than fiction. Mm-hmm. So a lot of like presidential history, things like that. Mm-hmm. Walk every day, gets my dog and I both out there, and so we're out there most days unless the weather is really, really bad. Mm-hmm. Or really, really cold, because she's a little delicate at times. So.
Right, right.
And motorcycle riding is a passion, has been for several years. And
it's not a great winter sport, but it's
no, this year's been kind yes. to us, but in fact, I was out last week, but that I like it because I can concentrate on just that, and you have to be fully involved in the ride. Mm-hmm. And to be safe, and it really takes me away from thinking about anything else. I find that to be a really good type of break for me.
It's almost like meditation.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That it takes you out of one environment and lets you be fully in another without
yeah.
fully.
Yeah, it's I like just being fully engaged. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the ride.
And, mm-hmm. And do you ride with others, or do you ride by yourself mostly?
Both. The last couple of years, more myself, more on my own. Mm-hmm. than with groups. Early on, when I first was riding a lot, when I really got back into it back in the several years ago now, we did a lot of group riding. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were at different places in their lives where they had to kind of drop off from that. Their kids were getting a little older, and they had to, you know, back off time-wise a little bit.
Sure,
so
sure.
It put me out there by myself a little bit more, which I enjoy. I like that too.
Mm-hmm. So you took a big ride this past fall. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I took 28 days off from work and life and so forth, and went on a trip down the Blue Ridge Parkway, and then over into Tennessee, up to Nashville, then the Natchez Trace Parkway down through Tennessee, Mississippi, and then hit New Orleans for a couple of days. I'd never been there before, so that was a very good experience. And then across the Gulf Coast and over into Florida, and then back up.
Wow. Wow. Now, when you do that, you just keep your counsel for 28 days, or how did you pace yourself? Because that's almost like that could be like a silent retreat almost.
Yeah, and at times it was, and that part was good, but it's also I met up with my brother for a couple of days down in Virginia. And my wife met me at a couple of different points during the trip. But most of the time I was on my own. And sometimes the solitude is good. But I found that in a good way that I was more likely to talk to other people, just as far as chatting up a store clerk or somebody asking questions about the bike or whatever. And people are, when you're by yourself with a motorcycle, people are more likely to approach you.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And they feel much more comfortable than coming up to a group of people on motorcycles. So I got into some pretty engaging conversations over the course of the few weeks that I was out there, and really learned a lot about mm-hmm. people and and places. And it was a great trip. Totally worth the time.
Right, right. And in keeping with that kind of awareness, what joy or what profoundly grateful knowing has life brought you that you would not, that you did not anticipate?
I think that I really enjoy meeting strangers. Mm-hmm. I didn't used to be like that, but I enjoy that. But and also I think my watching my the way my family life has turned out has been really good. I'm very, you know, my son's 27, getting married. He's getting married January 9th. So seeing him mature and the type of man he's turned into, and you know, meeting a wonderful mate. You know, his fiance is just a great person. She's, you know, she fell right into our family life, and just seeing him succeed and be happy, I think, has been a big joy for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It sounds like you feel like life is whole.
Yeah, I think overall, one thing I've reflected on is that I've been reconnecting with a lot of old friends the last couple of years, and just seeing where everybody is, and everybody's happy, and everybody's doing okay, and they've raised their kids, and they're where they want to be. They're comfortable. They in life, you know, comfortable in themselves, and they like where they are, and it's nice seeing them in a good place too.
Yeah. And on that note, I think we'll stop. It's been really good to get to know you, Jim.
It's been a pleasure.
And we're gonna close with Badfinger's Baby Blue. And do you want to say anything about that before we?
Well, I've always liked the song, and then I was a big Breaking Bad fan, and this was this song was playing as the show ended, and it was the absolute perfect choice for that.
Yes, yes. Okay, here it goes.